Welcome back, everyone. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
This time, we're tackling a really significant topic, the legacy of British rule in India.
It's a period that spans almost two centuries.
It is, a time when India was completely transformed by British influence, for better, and honestly, often for worse.
Yeah, it's complicated.
It is. We'll be using a lot of different sources, you know, starting from the East India Company's first steps, all the way to the rise of Indian nationalism, and ultimately, that road to independence.
It's quite the journey.
It is. Think of it this way. India, before British rule, it was this incredibly intricate, diverse tapestry. And then British rule arrives and, well, they added some new threads, you know, some bold colors, but it also kind of frayed some of those existing ones.
Yeah, a lot of loose ends.
Yeah, and we're going to see how those changes really played out over time.
Should we start with the early days then? The East India Company, right. They came for trade, but they ended up governing a huge and complex subcontinent.
Yeah, it's almost like they tripped and fell into an empire, isn't it?
Yeah.
One minute they're just merchants and the next they're running a whole country.
Exactly. And as Metcalf and Metcalf point out, they were so unprepared for this. Like, you can imagine these agents, they were focused on getting spices and textiles, right? And suddenly they're collecting taxes, trying to administer justice and navigate this incredibly intricate Indian society. It was a huge learning curve, no doubt.
A steep one. And did this lack of understanding, this kind of learn-as-you-go approach, did it have consequences?
Absolutely. One of the most striking examples is, well, how they handled the zamindari system. You see, they were trying to simplify things, make the land revenue system more efficient, at least from their point of view. But they actually ended up creating a whole mess of problems.
The zamindari system, that's where they basically assign landlords to collect taxes, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one. But the British, they totally misunderstood the existing system. They saw zamindars as landlords who had absolute ownership, like in England. But in India, land rights were much more complicated. The zamindar, they traditionally collected rent, sure, but they weren't the only owners. And this misunderstanding had a domino effect.
So what happened? Did it all kind of backfire on them?
Oh, it did, in a few ways. Mm-hmm. First, the British put these massive tax burdens on the zamindars, way more than they were used to. And this led to a lot of estates being sold off, essentially dispossessing many of the traditional landholders.
Rough.
It is. And then, maybe even more importantly, it really chipped away at the traditional rights of the peasants. Now, they were tenants at the mercy of this new system. Metcalf and Metcalf, they paint a pretty bleak picture of all this, showing how it led to, well, more poverty, more hardship for rural communities. It's a classic example of, you know, how good intentions, but without really understanding the situation, can actually do more harm than good.
It's like trying to shove a square peg into a round hole. The whole thing just falls apart.
Exactly. And unfortunately, this pattern, this misunderstanding leading to unintended consequences, well, it kept going, even as the East India Company turned into the British Raj.
So it wasn't just a temporary glitch. It had a real lasting impact.
Oh, a huge impact. The economic policies of the British Raj, they were built on this foundation of control, of taking resources, and they had huge consequences for India. They basically turned the whole country into like a giant supply depot, raw materials for their growing industries back in Britain.
So it was all about serving British interests then?
Well, let's just say self-interest played a big role. They flooded the Indian market with cheap manufactured goods, you know, straight from Britain. And that undercut local industries and artisans. Think about it. India, famous for its incredible textiles. Suddenly they're forced to import cloth from, say, Manchester. It crippled their local industries. It created this cycle of dependency.
And it lasted for generations.
It did. And I bet this economic control wasn't just about textiles, right?
You're right.
Yeah. Economists like Damodaran, they've looked at this really closely, you know, showing how the British systematically dismantled India's once thriving shipbuilding industry, for example. They put all these tariffs and restrictions in place, basically forcing Indian merchants to rely on British ships for their trade. This wasn't just about economics, it was about power, making sure India stayed under British control.
Tightening the grip, right. But there was a cultural shift happening too, wasn't there? I mean, the British brought their own education, languages, institutions. That must have had an impact as well.
You're absolutely right. The cultural transformations are just as important as the economic ones. And they're definitely intertwined. The British, they really saw their own culture as superior. You know, like it was a civilizing force. They thought they were going to uplift India. So they start introducing English language education, setting up universities based on Oxford and Cambridge, implementing a legal system pulled straight from British common law.
So, like a mini England in India.
Kind of, yeah. But the interesting thing is, much like those economic policies we talked about, these efforts had unintended consequences too.
How so?
Well, take the English language, for instance. They promoted it to create this class of Indians who could, be intermediaries, administrators, clerks, basically serve the colonial system. But what they ended up doing was giving Indians this incredibly powerful tool for communication, for intellectual exchange, and eventually even for challenging colonial rule.
Wow, it's like they gave them the key to the library, thinking they'd just check out the approved books.
Yeah.
But Indians started writing their own chapters.
That's a great way to put it. And that's when we start seeing the rise of Indian nationalism. Thinkers like Ram Mohan Roy, educated in English, exposed to Western ideas, they began advocating for social reform and more autonomy for India. He even founded the Brahmo Samaj, a movement challenging traditional Hindu orthodoxy, while also critiquing aspects of British rule.
So, kind of a two-pronged critique, pushing back against forces both inside and outside.
Exactly. And that's an important point. Indian nationalism wasn't just reacting to British rule. It was also shaped by internal debates, reform movements that were already happening. British presence, in a way, it sped things up. It was a catalyst, forcing Indians to confront their own identity on this larger scale.
It's like the British shook up the kaleidoscope. And all the different pieces, all these ideas and identities, they started shifting and rearranging.
Great analogy. And this process of re-examination, of redefinition, it happened everywhere. Look at organizations like the Indian National Congress, formed in 1885. Initially, they focused on working within the system, advocating for more Indian participation in the government. But as time passed, it became a platform for bolder demands, self-rule, and eventually complete independence.
So a shift from reform to revolution.
You could say that. And this evolution, it was partly driven by the very policies the British put in place, the education systems, the infrastructure, even those unintended consequences of their economic exploitation.
Right, like the railway network. We talked about that.
Exactly. Built to move troops and resources, it also ended up connecting different parts of India like never before.
It's like they accidentally stitched the diverse tapestry of India together with these steel threads.
Exactly. And this interconnectedness, being able to travel and communicate more easily, it created this growing sense of shared identity, of being Indian, beyond regional or religious differences. Another example of how British actions often backfired, this time accidentally fostering the national unity they were trying so hard to suppress.
It's almost ironic, isn't it? They tried to control India, but ended up creating the conditions for its eventual freedom.
Irony indeed. And this brings us to another really important part of the colonial legacy, the rise of communal tensions, especially between Hindus and Muslims. Now, it's key to remember, religious differences, they existed in India long before the British.
Of course, India has always been diverse in faiths and beliefs.
Absolutely. But the British, with their divide and rule policy, well, they often made these differences worse, used it for their own political gain.
Do you have an example of how that played out?
Sure. Think about the partition of Bengal in 1905. On the surface, it was for administrative efficiency. But many saw it as, well, a deliberate move to weaken the growing nationalist movement, divide the province along religious lines, creating a separate Muslim-majority East Bengal.
So, carving up the map to fit their own agenda.
Pretty much. And even though the partition was eventually reversed, it left this lasting scar, fueling resentment and distrust between Hindus and Muslims. And it led to separate political organizations popping up, like the Muslim League. They started advocating for a separate Muslim state.
So this divide and rule, while it might have worked for the British in the short term, ultimately it contributed to those divisions that led to the tragic partition of India in 1947.
A very tragic legacy. It reminds us that the past, it continues to affect us today. But it's not just about division. The British also left this complex legal and administrative structure, and for all its faults, it became the basis for modern India's institutions.
So even as they were creating division, they were laying the foundation for a unified India.
That's the paradox of this period. It's all contradictions, progress and exploitation, unity and division. And as we move into the final part of this deep dive, we'll see how these competing forces ultimately culminated in India's fight for independence, the birth of a new nation.
So we've been going deep into this really complex time in Indian history, British rule, its impacts, and how it ultimately led to India's independence. It seems clear this period was a huge melting pot of change, But how did everyday Indians, you know, how did they experience all this? I mean, their world was being reshaped by all these forces outside of their control.
That's a really important point to consider. It's easy to get caught up in the big picture, the policies, the movements, but it's vital to remember this was real life for millions of people. And how they reacted, well, it was just as diverse and multifaceted as India itself.
So there wasn't one single response. People reacted in different ways.
Oh, absolutely. Some people, they saw opportunity in the new order. They embraced things like, say, English education, saw it as a way to move up, you know, socially, economically, a way to get ahead in this new world. Others, though, they held tight to their traditions. They saw British influence as a direct threat to their way of life.
Kind of like some tried to adapt and blend in, while others resisted and held on to their roots.
That's a great way to put it. And these reactions, they weren't always so black and white either. You'd see people adapting in some areas and resisting in others, like embracing Western education, but fiercely opposing any British attempts to meddle with their religious practices, their customs.
A real balancing act, trying to find their way in this new landscape while still holding on to their own identity.
Exactly. And this whole process of negotiation, it played out in some really fascinating ways. Take the rise of Hindu nationalism, for instance. That wasn't just a reaction to British rule. It was also a response to this perceived threat from Islam, which, under the British Raj, sometimes seemed to be getting preferential treatment.
So it was a way of asserting their Hindu identity, you know, in this shifting political and social environment.
Exactly. Scholars, like those who wrote Hindu Mahasabha in colonial North India, 1915-1930, argue that groups like the Hindu Mahasabha, well, they emerged partly because of this anxiety. They were advocating for Hindu interests, pushing back against what they saw as concessions being made to Muslims.
Wow. It's like another layer of complexity in the independence movement.
It definitely adds another layer, and it highlights this really important point. The fight for independence wasn't just about getting rid of British rule. It was also about defining what India would become after independence.
Right. What kind of nation would it be? Who would have the power? What would its values be?
Those were questions being debated even while they were fighting for freedom. And those debates, well, they're still going on in India today.
It shows how history is not just the past. It really shapes the present in such big ways.
Absolutely. And speaking of shaping the present, one of the most inspiring things about this period is how Indians found ways to resist British control even when they couldn't do it openly.
You mean like beyond the organized political movements?
Exactly. Think about it. The British, they controlled the official stories, the textbooks, the institutions, but they couldn't control the stories people told each other, the songs they sang, the traditions they passed down.
It's like this hidden transcript running alongside the official one.
Exactly. You see examples in folk tales, songs from this era, subtly mocking British authority or celebrating local heroes who resisted. It was a way for people to hold on to their identity, their history, even under British rule.
It really shows the power of culture. How it can be a form of resistance,
yeah.
You know, keeping your spirit alive even when you're not free.
I love that. And this cultural resistance, this affirmation of Indian identity, it was crucial in the fight for independence. It helped bring people together, gave them a shared goal, and helped them envision a future without colonial rule.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the colonial legacy, what are some key things our listeners should remember?
Well, it's important to remember this period, it was far more complex than just oppressor versus oppressed. It was a time of huge change, definitely, but also of adaptation, resistance, and ultimately of Indians shaping their own destiny.
It's about seeing those nuances, the different forces at play, the unexpected outcomes, and above all, the role that the Indian people played in making their own history.
Exactly. And as you all continue to learn about this fascinating period, I encourage you to keep those complexities in mind. Look beyond those big narratives. See the human stories, the struggles, the triumphs, and that lasting legacy of this truly transformative era.
Beautifully said. It's a good reminder that history never really ends. It lives on in us, shapes our world in ways we both see and don't see. So as always, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep uncovering those hidden layers of our shared past. Until next time, happy deep diving.